forces learn to look for the wire and kill the person waiting at the other end. By the following winter, about half the bombs were remote-controlled, frequently set off using cellular telephones, car alarm transmitters, or toy car controllers. For charges, insurgents usually used 155mm artillery shells and a variety of mortar rounds, and occasionally TNT or a plastic explosive. The bombs at first were concealed under rocks or piles of trash, which were everywhere along Baghdad's streets, as social services failed to resume after the war. Others were hidden in the carcasses of dead dogs, which, in the humid summer heat of Iraq, produced a putrid smell that would deter all but the most dedicated soldier from probing for bombs. Early on, one favored tactic was to block the road with a truck or bus that would appear to be stalled or broken down, and then plant a series of bombs behind the vehicle in the area along the road where the U.S. convoy would be forced to stop. U.S. troops responded by driving up on the sidewalk or in the incoming lane of traffic, which got them out of the trap, but inadvertently served the insurgents' secondary purpose of angering and alienating Iraqis who had to scramble out of the way of the careening convoy. As the insurgency was heating up in the Sunni Triangle, Lieutenant Colonel Steve Russell, based in its northern part in the town of Tikrit, was dealing with a wave of attacks in which bombers were using the transmitters from radio-controlled toy cars. They would take the electronic guts of the cars, wrap them in C4 plastic explosive, and attach a blasting cap, then detonate them by remote control. So Russell, who commanded an infantry battalion, mounted one of the toy car controllers on the dashboard of his Humvee and taped down the levers. Because all the toy cars operated on the same frequency, this would detonate any similar bomb about 100 yards before his Humvee got to the spot. This poor man's anti-explosive device was risky, perhaps, Russell wrote in a 58-page summary of his unit's time in Iraq, but better than the alternative of leaving the detonation to the bombers. The most effective counter-bomb tactic turned out to be the low-tech sniper. U.S. troops learned to hide and spy on spots, such as traffic circles, where bombs were likely to be emplaced. "Anyone who comes out in the middle of the night to plant an IED dies," a senior Central Command official reported. The typical IED cell, American intelligence analysts concluded, usually consisted of 6 to 8 people. It was led by a planner-financier. Next came the bomb maker, who handled the construction of the device, but not its delivery. The third specialist was the emplacer, who would plant the bomb by pretending to fix a flat or fire, or in some customized vehicles, would drop the bomb through a hole cut in the floor of a car. In addition, the cell had a triggerman, who would detonate the bomb, and perhaps a spotter or two to provide security for the rest of the team. Many cells had someone in an additional role. Cameraman. According to U.S. intelligence, the majority of bomb attacks were videotaped by the bomb cell, in part as a learning device to improve attacks, in part for propaganda and recruiting purposes. This reliance on video cameras was one reason that U.S. troops became so antagonistic toward television news cameramen, especially those of Arab ethnicity, whom the troops tended to assume were in league with the insurgents. There is an element, and I am not saying this applies everywhere, but some of the local hires of some of the local media organizations do their agencies a disservice because they've got links to insurgents and terrorist organizations, said Army General George Casey, who took over command in mid-2004. We have not found that rampantly, but we know it's true in a few cases. Most of the U.S. responses to the bomb attacks were reactive. About half the attacks during the summer of 2003 were against soft-skinned Humvees, which were lacking any armor. During the fall and winter of 2003-4, the Army emphasized adding armor to vehicles, but partly because it kept underestimating the depth and breadth of the insurgency, it struggled for over a year to get its people into better protected vehicles. It also studied the frequencies on which car alarm transmitters and other devices operated, and began to jam them with mobile electronic gear. Despite these steps, the toll from the bombs increased with the passage of time. During 2003, there was only one month, November, when the insurgency took off with a Ramadan offensive, in which more than 20 U.S. personnel were lost to roadside bombs and similar landmines, according to a mortality analysis by the Office of the Armed Forces Medical Examiner. But from January through November 2004, more than 20 troops were killed that way in every month but two. November 2004 was the worst of all, with more than 40 soldiers lost to the bombs. What those numbers disguise is that the toll would have been higher were it not for the improvements in armor defenses, because the number of bomb attacks increased steadily in 2004. IEDs are my number one threat, General Abizaid stated in a memorandum sent in June of that year to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But they were hardly ubiquitous. Most of the bombings occurred along major routes in a surprisingly small area, along about a total of 250 miles of roadway in Baghdad, and leading from the capital city to the west, north, and northeast. Every day, hundreds of U.S. convoys traveled these main supply routes, becoming targets that were hit with surprising frequency. For every military tactic, there is a countermeasure. As one Army general noted, military operations are a giant, lethal version of the children's game of rock, paper, scissors. Adding armor to U.S. military vehicles inevitably led to new moves by the bombers. In the winter of 2004 through 5, they began concealing IEDs among overhanging branches and leaves. Iraq, between the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers, is quite lush. Or hanging them from light poles. The purpose of this, said one Army engineer studying the problem in Baghdad, appeared to be to move the bomb blast above the armored doors, so that the effect shattered the windshields and side windows inward, and also to hit the soldiers manning the guns mounted atop many vehicles. Vehicle-borne IEDs, or car bombs, also became popular in the fall and winter of 2003. Troops soon were taught to be on the lookout for a new set of telltale signs, such as the jalopy so overladen that it sat low on its springs. Another was fresh tires on an old car. This is a one-way trip. Driver wants no flats, a 2004 briefing explained. Bomb explosions frequently were experienced as overwhelming waves of light. It just happened in a flash, recalled Sergeant First Class Eric Mocker in a typical comment. You hear it. The blast smashes everything in the vehicle. As they treated bomb injuries, Army doctors began to notice a new pattern of problems in soldiers that resulted from brains being rattled around in the skull by the blasts. In 2003 and 4, hundreds of soldiers were diagnosed as suffering some form of damage from such incidents. Even seasoned surgeons were surprised by the extent of it. Army Reserve Major Donald Robinson was a trauma specialist in inner-city Camden, New Jersey, before deploying to Iraq. But he was surprised by what he found in the war. When I got there, I was taken aback, he said. This was penetrating trauma to the nth degree. It was massive. The tissue destruction was like nothing I'd ever seen before. Imagine shards of metal going everywhere. Add the percussion from the blast, then put someone inside a Bradley fighting vehicle and add fire to it and burning flesh. A person inhales and suffers inhalation injury. But in an insurgency, it is the political result that is always paramount. Though devastating physically, the most significant effect of roadside bombs was that they made U.S. troops wary of operating among the people. The fact that insurgents were able to place so many bombs, often repeatedly along the same stretches of road, also made a political statement, because it meant that the locals weren't reporting on them. Coalition forces are forced to interact with the Iraqi populace from a defensive posture, effectively driving a psychological wedge between the people and their protectors, Major General Peter Chiarelli, who commanded the 1st Cavalry Division in Iraq in 2004, observed. That sort of insight, built on an understanding of the nature of conducting a counterinsurgency campaign, had been rare among Army commanders in Iraq during the summer of 2003. The Army's original plan was to conduct a force withdrawal beginning in mid-summer 2003, bringing its presence down to about 30,000 troops by late summer. Instead, late summer was when the situation in Iraq really began to feel like a war for many of the 130,000 American soldiers in the country. August 29 brought the third major car bombing of the month as insurgents hit another ally of the U.S. effort, Shiite political leader Ayatollah Mohammed Bakir Hakim. The leader of SCIRI, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, Hakim had been one of the most important political figures in Iraq and the most influential religious figure to have openly supported the U.S. occupation. The car bomb that killed him soon after Friday prayers in the holy city of Najaf also murdered more than 90 others. The message was that the United States, for all its firepower, couldn't protect its Iraqi allies. During late July and August, Generals Abizaid and Sanchez discussed with their division commanders and other top officers three possible responses to the insurgency, recalled Major General Renouart. One was tactical withdrawal from trouble spots. Take a city like Ramadi or Fallujah and tell them to police it and run it themselves, he said. The second was use small elements like SF, Special Forces teams, to do raids and a surgical application of power. The third was, you are present in cities, and you are intimidating enough to create security by presence. Ultimately, we decided all three had a place. One reason for that was that Abizaid didn't want to limit the choices available to the division commanders. If you need to use a scalpel, here's a scalpel, was the thinking, Renouart said. If you need to use a mallet, I don't want to take that away from you. But there were many more sledgehammers than scalpels in the U.S. Army inventory, both physically and mentally. Even the short-term successes of the U.S. Army in Iraq seemed to have long-term costs that went unrecognized at the time. The story of how intelligence operations were revamped in the fall of 2003 illustrates this sad pattern. All summer long, commanders had fretted about the poor quality of their intelligence. Several months into the war, they had no idea who the enemy really was, nor did they know much about what Iraqis thought of them, especially the views of those beyond the narrow world of those, such as interpreters, who were on the U.S. payroll. Recognizing their profound lack of understanding, American commanders launched a major effort in the fall of 2003 to improve U.S. intelligence gathering and analysis. On October 1, Abizaid issued an order to reorganize intelligence operations in Iraq so that all the data gathered would pour into one new intelligence fusion center. In this new organization, analysts would work side by side with interrogators and the CIA would cooperate with military intelligence. Until the fall, the CIA, the special operations units, and the divisions all had separate databases. Now, a new database would be created to try to ensure, for example, that someone detained and released in Ramadi would trigger an alert when he was caught a week later in Mosul with traces of explosives on his hands. Most important, networks would be delineated so that the U.S. effort would go after not just the frontline delivery men of roadside bombs, but also some of the commanders running the bomb factories, the keepers of safe houses and villages on the outskirts of Baghdad, the financiers sending in new funds and supplies, and the recruiters training people and sending them in across the Syrian border. In the fall, CENTCOM spent $11 million to create an intelligence architecture for this, a senior official in that headquarters said. These steps were seen inside the Army as a major success story, and they were portrayed as such to journalists. Yet it was not so, even though it felt that way to many officers, probably to the majority of those involved. In insurgencies, lots of things are counterintuitive, one expert who consulted with U.S. military intelligence in Iraq said later. That is, the move that seems reasonable may not actually be the wise one. For example, getting better intelligence was a laudable tactical goal, but launching an all-out offensive that used combat methods against the population to obtain it wasn't, because it undercut the larger strategic goal. The problem was that the U.S. military, having assumed it would be operating in a relatively benign environment, wasn't set up for a massive effort that called on it to apprehend, detain, and interrogate Iraqis, to analyze the information gleaned, and then act on it. As commanders at all levels sought operational intelligence, it became apparent that the intelligence structure was undermanned, under-equipped, and inappropriately organized for counterinsurgency operations, Lieutenant General Anthony Jones wrote in an official Army report a year later. The key to actionable intelligence was seen by many U.S. commanders as conducting huge sweeps to detain and question Iraqis. Sometimes, units acted on tips. But sometimes they just detained all able-bodied males of combat age in areas known to be anti-American. The 4th Infantry Division, operating in the northern and northeastern parts of the Sunni Triangle, soon attracted attention among other commanders for its eager embrace of such tactics. Other commanders were more discriminating. The 82nd Airborne Swanwick said his division detained 3,800 people between August 2003 and March 2004, but screened them and ultimately shipped only 700 of them to Abu Ghraib. His staff was wary of the operation at the prison, he recalled. They saw all these folks going into there, and it was hell to get them out of there. I had to personally intervene to get people out of there. They'd just get scarfed up. Paradoxically, after focusing too much on the operational level in its invasion plan, the Army focused too little on it during its subsequent occupation, said retired Major General Robert Scales, one of the Army's most insightful senior officers. Its battlefield orientation didn't prepare it to discern what the operational level was in a counterinsurgency. The operational level of war in Iraq was dealing with Iraqis, with non-governmental organizations, with the media, with the rest of the world, he said. The center of gravity was the will of the people. Again and again, the jobs that the Army failed to handle in Iraq in the summer and fall of 2003 would be in that crucial but neglected operational area of counterinsurgency, which simply means that no one was connecting all the dots. Supply convoys raced across the countryside to stock big U.S. bases, undercutting the larger effort, as drivers, worried U.S. troops or third world contractors, shot at Iraqi civilians to make them keep their distance. Personal security details for CPA officials rocketed through Baghdad, forcing Iraqi cars onto sidewalks, needlessly alienating the capital's population. Frustrated combat troops used force first, violating a lesson of every successful modern counterinsurgency campaign. Violence is the tool of last resort, especially for troops foreign to the local population. Civil affairs officers, whose job it is to work with local populations, clashed frequently with the commanders of units they were supposed to support because of the different imperatives they faced, with little direction from higher levels of command. All of these disparate areas were strands that should have been pulled together and coordinated by General Sanchez, the commander with oversight of operations across Iraq. But he failed to do that. U.S. Army divisions operated like fingers without an operational hand or strategic arm to guide them. Sanchez took a distant stance that gave each division commander leeway to handle the situation in his own area. Normally, such decentralization would be welcome, but it works only if guided by a larger strategy that coordinates each unit's actions. In military shorthand, that direction is called the commander's intent. Sanchez didn't provide it. Indeed, Sanchez's headquarters spent weeks debating a draft campaign plan, but never issued one during his time there. One Army intelligence officer who served in Iraq in 2004 was even more emphatic. For the first year of the war, there was no campaign plan issued to military personnel by CJTF-7 to deal with reconstruction of Iraq and to deal with the growing insurgency, he recalled. Various units subordinate to CJTF-7 essentially did what they thought was the right thing to do, but their efforts were not coordinated by any clear overarching campaign plan. The result, he said, was that the divisions were kind of left out there to dry by themselves. Policy consultant Andrew Rathmel came to a similar conclusion. The military leadership did not do a good job of conceptualizing the campaign as an integrated political-military effort, sometimes failing to put tactical kinetic operations in the broader political context. This meant that tactical successes never added up and reinforced each other, but rather tended to peter out by themselves. The result was that each sector felt like a separate war, with different approaches and rules, showing a lack of coordination that runs against the repeated findings of theorists and practitioners of counterinsurgency. In the North, Petraeus's 101st Airborne conducted what was generally seen as a thorough and effective operation, balancing war fighting and nation building. Just to the south, in the Sunni Triangle, there was an increasingly tough little war, especially in the area to the north and west of Baghdad, where the 4th Infantry Division was based. The 82nd Airborne and the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment, operating to the west of Baghdad, posted a mixed record, with some successes and fewer mass detentions, but also with Fallujah, Ramadi, and the upper Euphrates Valley turning into increasingly tough problems. At the country's center, Baghdad became an area for a series of terrorist bombings. The good side of Rick Sanchez is, because all the division areas were different, he kind of left us to figure out what we needed to do and how to do it, said Swanick, who commanded the 82nd Airborne Division in Iraq twice, first in the invasion in the spring of 2003, and then in the fall and winter of 2003-4. Sanchez didn't offer much strategic guidance, he said. It was pretty much, you do what you need to do and I'll give you the resources. He would try to raise tough issues with Sanchez by email, but sometimes never received a response. I don't know why. Responsiveness to division commanders' issues was weak. I never got a visit from anyone from CJTF 7 staff, concurred Major General Odierno, who commanded the 4th Infantry Division in the Northern Sunni Triangle. Sanchez visited me once, he added, holding up a lone index finger. Mosul, the biggest city in northern Iraq, could have erupted at any moment in 2003. As a U.S. military intelligence analysis warned at the outset of the invasion, Mosul came with a ready-made civil war, hosting some 110,000 former Iraqi army soldiers and 20,000 Kurdish militiamen happy to fight them. It also was the home base of the Iraqi Islamic Party, which had survived Saddam's efforts to crush it. The city overflowed with potential enemies of the U.S. occupation, so much so that Saddam Hussein's sons, Uday and Qusay, chose it as their hiding place. Despite that troublesome lineup, of all the divisions occupying Iraq in 2003-4, it was the 101st Airborne, commanded by Major General David Petraeus and headquartered in Mosul, that was most successful in launching an effective counterinsurgency campaign. Mosul and northern Iraq under Petraeus in 2003 offer a glimpse of how the occupation of Iraq might have been conducted more effectively, and in such a way that the hopes of bringing home most U.S. troops relatively soon might have been realized. There was no post-invasion pause in the north. Because the pace of U.S. operations never sagged, there was no breather in which the adversary could gain the initiative. The eerie silence and absence of U.S. military operational activity that defined the immediate weeks and months of transition were not present in the northern provinces. There was no hiatus, no ceasefire in the north, commented one officer, who served in Iraq first as an army historian and then as a strategist for Petraeus. Petraeus had more education about counterinsurgency operations than any other division commander in Iraq. During the 1980s, he had earned a Ph.D. in international relations at Princeton, where his dissertation subject had been the effect of the Vietnam War on U.S. military thinking about the use of force. In the course of his research, he had read deeply into the French experience in Indochina. While the French didn't win there or in Algeria, the vanquished often learn more from a war than do the victors. Counterinsurgency operations, in particular, require close civil-military cooperation, Petraeus wrote in his study. He warned against U.S. military attitudes that impeded the crucial integration of political and military strategies. Also, he noted that the use of force may be necessary, but by itself, it is seldom sufficient. Petraeus also took quiet steps to ensure unity of command in his area, a fundamental military principle to be sure, but something that the U.S. effort overall didn't enjoy. Unity was particularly important in the intelligence arena, where he had his chief of staff, Colonel James Laufenberg, pull together several divergent intelligence elements by creating a joint interagency task force for counterterrorism, an effort made easier because the CIA officer in Mosul was a former subordinate of Petraeus's with whom he had kept in touch. To ensure that all worked together, Petraeus also fired a warning shot across the bow of the black special operators in the 101st area. "We're delighted to have you with us," he told them, "but if you conduct operations without first getting our approval, I'll request your removal from our area of operations." He took pride in conducting targeted raids with a minimum of violence. In one, 101st troops and a special operations unit went after 35 suspects simultaneously in Mosul at 2 a.m. and caught 23 of those they were after with only a single shot fired. Petraeus said that his role was a combination of being the president and the pope. Others saw his role as somewhat less elevated. "Petraeus up north was like a politician. He bought everyone off," said Kellogg, the retired army general who served as a senior CPA official. Plainly stated, the 101st Airborne waged a different war in the north than was waged in other parts of the country, one major wrote. "Winning the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people was the guiding purpose of all civil military actions in the north. While other divisions conducted anti-insurgency operations aimed at killing the enemy," he concluded, "the 101st waged a counterinsurgency campaign meant to undercut support for the enemy." Petraeus and his subordinate commanders and staff devised a strategy based on three principles. First, this is a race against time. Second, the real goal is to create as many Iraqis as possible who feel they have a stake in the new Iraq, which created a yardstick by which to measure any proposed move. Will it give Iraqis a stake? The third principle governed the division's tactics. Will this operation produce more bad guys than it takes off the street by the way it's conducted? Understanding this, one of the 101st's company commanders, Captain Daniel Morgan, recalled that he decided to handle detainees differently than they were treated elsewhere. "My company did not blindfold our detainees. We did upon arrival in Mosul, but we realized within a month, June 2003, that this was of no significance and hurt us." Petraeus also decided that cordon and sweep operations, in which every military-age male in a given area was rousted, were pointless. He thought most Iraqi men, even insurgents, so valued their household privacy that they would surrender peacefully rather than subject their families to intrusive nighttime searches. So he had the 101st conduct cordon and knock searches, in which suspects were surrounded and then invited to turn themselves in. In addition, he said, there were so many phony tips passed by Iraqis feuding with each other that this softer approach helped sort out those tips without unnecessarily insulting Iraqi dignity. During the summer of 2003, a common rumor among Iraqis was that the night vision goggles used by American troops could enable them to peer through the clothes of women. When a brigade commander in the 101st, Colonel Ben Hodges, heard this from sheiks in his area, rather than just tell them it was false, he decided to show them by putting on an exhibition where a variety of U.S. military observation and imaging devices would be laid out for them to examine and use. The 101st staff laughingly referred to this as the first annual Tigris River Valley Sheik Fest, and then was pleasantly surprised to see the meeting repeated and evolve into a formal Tigris River Valley Commission in which regional issues could be discussed every month. A summary written by the staff of the 101st Airborne noted that by January of 2004, the north of Iraq appeared in remarkably good shape. There was an average of just 5 hostile contacts, bombs, ambushes, drive-by shootings, a day in the division's operating area. That figure included attacks not just on U.S. troops, but also on Iraqi security forces. By contrast, there were about 25 meetings a day between commanders in the division and local Iraqi leaders or managers of key facilities. But the city would encounter far more trouble after the 101st went home in the spring of 2004 and was replaced by a far smaller, less effective unit. Not all officers thought that Petraeus was blameless for that. He had 18,000 soldiers up there, and the enemy was just biding its time and building capacity, waiting them out, argued one skeptical military intelligence officer. That view seems unfair. Mosul was quiet while Petraeus was there, and likely would have remained so had his successor had as many troops as he had, and as much understanding of counterinsurgency techniques. Also, it is notable that the population-oriented approach Petraeus took in Mosul in 2003 would be the one the entire U.S. Army in Iraq was trying to adopt in 2006. To the west of Baghdad, Major General Charles Swanick got mixed reviews for being aggressive, but very selective, recalled Keith Mines. They didn't just go bouncing around. But, he told his family at the time in an email, their answer to everything is more firepower, while my answer to most everything is to get them back in their barracks and send me out with a suitcase of money. In the capital itself, the 1st Armored Division was led by Brigadier General Martin Dempsey, who generally was seen as handling a difficult job well under the global spotlight of Baghdad. North of Baghdad, Odierno's 4th Infantry Division operated in the northern part of the Sunni Triangle. His unit proved to be almost the opposite of Petraeus's 101st Airborne. As the Marines had suspected when turning over the area north of Baghdad, Odierno and his division would take a combative posture in Iraq. Odierno, he hammered everyone, said Kellogg, the retired Army general who was at CPA. Odierno's brigades and battalions earned a reputation for being overly aggressive. Again and again, internal Army reports and commanders in interviews said that this unit, a heavy armor division despite its name, used ham-fisted approaches that may have appeared to pacify its area in the short term, but in the process alienated large parts of the population. The 4th ID was bad, said one Army intelligence officer who worked with them. These guys are looking for a fight, he remembered thinking. I saw so many instances of abuses of civilians, intimidating civilians, our jaws dropped. 4th ID fueled the insurgency, added an Army psychological operations officer. He said that it frequently was manipulated by the insurgents into firing at innocent civilians. Guys had come up from Fallujah, set up next to a farmhouse, set off a mortar and leave, and the 4th ID would respond with counter-battery fire. The 4th ID CG, commanding general, fostered that attitude. They were cowboys. A general who served in Iraq, speaking on background, said flatly, the 4th ID, what they did was a crime. But on most days, there were relatively few outside observers watching the 4th ID. It was operating in the dank palm groves and the hot, dusty towns of the Tigris River Valley north of Baghdad, an area that was never welcoming for reporters and that grew increasingly difficult for civilian or military travel in the fall of 2003 and after. In one of his letters home, Lieutenant Colonel Steve Russell, a battalion commander in the 4th ID, offered his rationale for the strong-arm tactics he sometimes employed. We would not win the people of Tikrit over, he said. They generally hate us. We are kind and compassionate to those that work with us, but most detest us as a general rule. But they do respect power. Some have questioned our forcefulness, but we will not win them over by handing out lollipops, not in Tikrit. Too many of my bloodied men bear witness to this. They are the beer hall crowd of Munich in 1945. Lieutenant Colonel David Poirier, who commanded an MP battalion attached to the 4th Infantry Division and was based in Tikrit from June 2003 to March 2004, said that the division's approach was indiscriminate. With the brigade and battalion commanders, it became a philosophy. round up all the military-age males, because we don't know who's good or bad. He recalled that one brigade commander in the 4th ID blew up a house a guy was building, and called it a demonstration of force. Poirier was upset, in part because the owner of the house had been helping him with operations in the nearby town of Samara. They didn't seem to care, he recalled. Colonel Alan King, who had moved from the 3rd ID to the CPA, had a similar impression of the 4th ID's approach. Every male from 16 to 60 that the 4th ID could catch was detained, he said, and when they got out, they were supporters of the insurgency. It is not black and white, Odierno said at a meeting of the Association of the U.S. Army. Being too gentle also carried risks, he implied. We'd go in, do a raid on a house, and we wouldn't search any of the families, and as we were leaving, they would hand weapons from under their dresses to their men who would shoot at us. So, he said, yeah, initially we probably made some mistakes. But, he continued, we adapted quickly. One of the problems, he added, was that only one side in the fighting, his, was required to play by rules. They were not constrained. He elaborated on his views in an article in the Army's Field Artillery magazine. He made the point, worth noting, that his troops faced a population more hostile than in the rest of Iraq. From June 2003 to January 2004, we had three times more than the combined number of attacks in the rest of the Iraqi theater. The decentralization under Lieutenant General Sanchez sometimes extended even further down, to the levels of brigades and battalions. In the 4th Infantry Division in particular, noticed an Army intelligence officer, there were two brigade commanders whose sectors were side by side in the Sunni Triangle, yet used vastly different approaches. On the west bank of the river, around Samara and Balad, was Colonel Frederick Rudesheim. Rudesheim said, I really want to support civil affairs. He gave them augmentation, additional troops, security. He said that civil affairs was his bread and butter. Meanwhile, on the east side of the Tigris River, around Bakaba, Colonel David Hogg was operating on a war footing that focused much more on action against the insurgents and intimidation of others. Hogg said that his forces were there to kill the enemy, not to win their hearts or minds, recalled Major Christopher Varhola, an Army Reserve specialist in civil affairs who worked in a large swath of Iraq. The insurgency remained all but invisible except during its attacks. It issued no statements. Unlike other insurgencies, such as in Algeria in the 1950s, it had no visible leaders or spokesmen, no diplomatic offices operating in friendly Arab capitals. All that was really known of it was its location and tactics. Most of the insurgency was in the Sunni Triangle, the area dominated by Sunni Muslims, who were a minority in Iraq but had ruled the country for decades, that extended west of Baghdad to Ramadi and then up the Euphrates River north from the capital along the Tigris to Samara and Beji, and northeast to Bakaba. Tactically, the insurgency was generally low-tech. The U.S. wasn't a colonial power in Iraq, seeking to hold on to a restive province, but it sometimes acted like one. This is the way an administration caught with its plans down habitually reacts under such circumstances, Alistair Horn wrote in A Savage War of Peace, the classic history of the French War in Algeria in the 1950s. Whether it be the British in Palestine, Cyprus, or Northern Ireland, the Portuguese in Mozambique, or the French in Indochina, first comes the mass indiscriminate roundup of suspects, most of them innocent, but converted into ardent militants by the fact of their imprisonment. Through their lack of discrimination, such tactics tend to have powerful unintended negative political effects on the population. Not only do they alienate those affected, they also show that the military force conducting the operation is ignorant, because supportive and neutral natives are caught up with hostile ones. This does two things, concluded a 2005 study by Hicks and Associates, a small but influential Pentagon consulting firm. For potential government collaborators, it makes them less sure that the government will protect them from harm. For potential insurgents, it makes them less worried that they will be caught if they join the insurgents. Family members were sometimes taken into captivity to force suspects to turn themselves in. "The families know what's going on," Colonel Hogg said one day in late July 2003, standing in the ankle-deep khaki-colored dust at the front gate of his base and wearing his full battle gear of body armor, helmet, and pistol. "So we picked up the family of a Republican Guard lieutenant general last night," he said, puffing on a Dominican cigar. "He wasn't there. We brought in his wife and daughter and left him a note. 'We know where you are. We know what car you drive. If you want your family released, turn yourself in.'" This really wasn't hostage-taking, he contended. "It's an intelligence operation with detainees," pointing toward a difference that wasn't immediately apparent. "These people have information. The wife denied her husband was in the military until we showed her his general's uniform." Hogg's major complaint at the time was about the media's coverage of U.S. military operations, which he saw as negative. "I don't think they're fully reporting the success we're having," he said genially. "We've put a lot of bad guys away, either through detaining or killing them. That is having a positive effect with Iraqis, who are coming to us more, telling us more, working with us more." Like many commanders, Hogg thought the media just didn't understand how much progress had been made by the U.S. military. "I think we're fixing to turn the corner," he said that hot day in July 2003. "I think the operations over the next couple of weeks will get us there." But there was also unease being expressed about this heavy-handed approach, both inside the U.S. military and among Iraqis talking to U.S. officers. "Hogg was an excellent brigade commander," recalled Lieutenant Colonel Christopher Holshek, commander of the 402nd Civil Affairs Battalion, which moved to Baqaba that fall to work for Hogg. But Holshek thought that in the summer and fall of 2003, Hogg's tactics were unnecessarily aggressive and even counterproductive. He said he tried a few times, unsuccessfully, to figure out how to make that case. In places like Fallujah and Baqaba, tactical commanders began to learn when conducting raids and sweeps that in the process of kicking down doors in the middle of the night to find bad guys, and often kicking down the wrong doors, entering the private space of the house where the women and children were, then tying up and interrogating, i.e. humiliating the man in the house in front of his family, the premier cultural value of family honor was violated, Holshek later wrote. Hallenbeck remembered being taken aside by a sheik in Mosul. The Iraqi leader emphasized that he considered it essential for the Americans to succeed. "If you leave," he told Hallenbeck, "my Mercedes will be right behind the last truck in your convoy." He knew he wouldn't survive without them. "But damn it," the sheik continued, "you have got to stop this middle-of-the-night knock-on-the-door searches, throwing people on the ground, making them see red." "Many of the arrests were done with a boot on the head in front of his woman," said Hams. "You've created a blood debt when you do that." A year later, an official Pentagon investigation would come to much the same conclusion. Line units conducting raids found themselves seizing specifically targeted persons, so designated by military intelligence, the Pentagon's Schlesinger report found. But lacking interrogators and interpreters to make precise distinctions in an alien culture and hostile neighborhoods, they reverted to rounding up any and all suspicious-looking persons, all too often including women and children. The flood of incoming detainees contrasted sharply with the trickle of released individuals. This indiscriminate approach actually hindered the American goal of improving intelligence, the report noted. Processing was overwhelmed. Some detainees at Abu Ghraib had been held 90 days before being interrogated the first time. The U.S. military was badly prepared for handling a flood of prisoners. By late autumn, Abu Ghraib contained some 10,000 prisoners. U.S. military intelligence officials later estimated that most of those detained were more or less innocent, and that the vast majority, perhaps 90%, had no intelligence value. "The detention facilities available were so limited," Sanchez said in a legal statement, "that you had to put them all in there, and it was this challenge of having at any given time 10 to 12,000, 13,000 of these people that had to be segregated and isolated and prioritized and interrogated in order for us to be able to identify the way these cells were working." What wasn't widely understood at the time, or even now outside the military, is that the overcrowding at the prison and some of the resulting lapses in supervision resulted directly from tactical decisions made by Sanchez and his division commanders, most notably the 4th ID's General Odierno. In the fall of 2003, they were stuffing Abu Ghraib with thousands of detainees, the majority of them bystanders caught up in the sweeps. Brigadier General Karpinski, the reserve MP officer overseeing detentions across Iraq, drew a distinction between the operations run by Swanick and Odierno. Mobile interrogators attached to each division were supposed to interview and screen detained Iraqis, shipping to the Abu Ghraib prison only those who offered the prospect of having some intelligence value. The 82nd's interrogators did it right, she said in 2005. They'd interview 25 and send 3 to me. Odierno's guys had grabbed 25 and sent 25, or 50, by including a bunch from his holding pen. The 82nd was the best. Petraeus was pretty good, but the 1st AD would send a lot, and the 4th ID was the worst. Sanchez, frustrated by his puzzling enemy, on September 14 approved 29 interrogation techniques to be used at the prison and elsewhere. It was the first time that an interrogation policy had been set in Iraq by the U.S. military, another reflection of the lack of expectation of an insurgency. His memorandum listed a dozen interrogation techniques not in standard usage by the Army, 5 more even than were being used at Guantanamo Bay. Even in approving them, his memorandum noted that other countries believed that the detainees were prisoners of war and that some of the methods being discussed were inconsistent with the Geneva Conventions governing their treatment. CENTCOM reviewed his decision, and a month later scaled it back, telling him it was unacceptably aggressive, according to a subsequent Pentagon inquiry. He was told to drop 10 of the 29 interrogation procedures he had approved. His superseding memo incorporating that order was issued on October 12. Back in the United States, the split in the views of the situation in Iraq was deepening. In the fall of 2003, Anthony Zinni began speaking out again, bitterly denouncing Rumsfeld, criticizing the Iraqi occupation, and saying it lacked a coherent strategy, a serious plan, and sufficient resources. "There is no strategy or mechanism for putting the pieces together," he told a gathering of the U.S. Naval Institute and the Marine Corps Association in Crystal City, Virginia, within walking distance of the Pentagon. "We're in danger of failing." The situation was worse than the newspapers had been portraying it, he told his audience. He mocked the premature celebration of victory against a weak Iraqi military. "Ohio State beat Slippery Rock 62-0. No shit." Yet now, he said, the jihadis were flocking to Iraq from around the Mideast. "We need to seal the borders," a view that the Pentagon would come to endorse more than a year later. The U.S. military was unbeatable at fighting, but not much good at the larger tasks, Zinni said. "We are great at the tactical problems, the killing and the breaking. We are lousy at the strategic part." Nor should the Pentagon be overseeing the occupation. Why the hell would the Department of Defense be the organization in our government that deals with the reconstruction of Iraq, he asked. "Doesn't make sense. We can't go on breaking our military and doing things like we're doing now," he said. "It kills me when I hear of the casualties and the sacrifice that's being made, especially because the casualties are being suffered because some policy wonk back here had a brain fart of an idea of strategy." Invoking the most emotional of comparisons for U.S. military officers of his generation, he ended by warning that Iraq was beginning to feel to him like the Vietnam War. "My contemporaries, our feelings and sensitivities were forged on the battlefields of Vietnam, where we heard the garbage and the lies, and we saw the sacrifice," said Zinni. "We swore never again would we allow that to happen. I ask you, is it happening again?" There were hundreds of Marine and Navy officers present, and many of those present rose to give his denunciation of their civilian leaders a standing ovation. From the perspective of top U.S. officials, things were going far better than Zinni suggested. At about the same time that he was speaking in Washington, Rumsfeld flew out to Iraq, where his tour turned into a concentrated attack on the media's coverage of events there. At the end of a long day, Rumsfeld, Bremer, and Sanchez met with reporters at Camp Victory, one of Saddam's palaces near the Baghdad airport. Rumsfeld: "There's so much reporting about Baghdad and so little about what's taking place in the rest of the country. I feel that the progress in 4 or 5 months is breathtaking." Bremer: "Mr. Secretary, I would just add a little more on the point you made about the good news. Every day in this country there are dozens of success stories. Schools were being built," he said. "Hospitals reopened, and local governments stood up." Bremer: "Democracy is on the march in this country." Rumsfeld: "And if you think about it, it happened in 4 or 5 months. 4 or 5 months, not 4 or 5 years. 4 or 5 months. If one looks back at Germany, at Japan, at Bosnia, at Kosovo, and measures the progress that's taken place in this country in 4 or 5 months, it dwarfs any other experience that I'm aware of." At this point, Sanchez got with the spirit of the session. Sanchez: "Mr. Secretary, ladies and gentlemen, it is very disturbing for me when I sit here every day and watch the news back home that focuses on the bad things that are occurring in Iraq, and I see my soldiers that have suffered either wounds or have gotten killed, and we're not paying the right credit to their sacrifices. So," the general admonished the group of reporters, "we need to capture the great news out there and make sure that America knows what her sons and daughters are doing and what the rest of the international community is doing here in Iraq." A few days later, Wolfowitz struck a similar theme in a round of congressional testimony in support of an $87 billion budget supplement for spending on Iraq. He seemed to be saying that talking a good game was essential. "You know, confidence is part of winning," he told the Senate Armed Services Committee. "We need to project confidence, and we have every reason to project confidence because we've done a fantastic job. We've liberated a country from a horrible dictator. We are cleaning up the remnants of that regime. We have the people with us." Unjustified optimism would prove to be one of the enduring characteristics of the U.S. management of the war. As late as mid-October 2003, as violence was spiking, top U.S. commanders were sketching plans for a troop drawdown in the summer of 2004. Cutting from 130,000 to perhaps 100,000 in the summer of 2004, and half that by the following year. In fact, in December 2005, the level would instead be substantially higher, at 159,000. At the same time, they hoped Iraqi security forces would be taking responsibility for patrolling the cities, while U.S. forces moved off stage, where they would play a less obtrusive role as a quick reaction force to rescue Iraqi units that got into trouble. This phased series of troop reductions was in the advanced stages of planning, but not yet approved by Secretary Rumsfeld, a senior official said on October 17. To others, that talk of troop cuts was unrealistic. "There was this big emphasis on troop reductions," said a civilian U.S. official who frequently interacted with the military at Green Zone meetings. "They should have been doing a risk assessment. Instead, in that October period, CJTF-7 was focused on planning the troop rotation and the reductions that would follow. To me, it was pretty clear that security had not been achieved. They hadn't done an adequate mission analysis. They should have gone back upstairs and said, 'The insurgency is strong and growing stronger, and the need to train Iraqi security forces is huge, and we need to beef up our forces to give them the space to develop capacity.'" On October 26, the night that the Muslim holy month of Ramadan began, PFC Rachel Bosfeld, a 19-year-old MP from Wisconsin in Colonel Teddy Spain's unit, was at the Abu Ghraib police station in the town near the prison, west of Baghdad. "A mortar came in, killed her, and blew the leg off another soldier," Spain recalled. Her death was significant for two reasons. First, it was barely noted. In a departure from past wars, the loss of 48 female soldiers from 2003 through 2005 hardly caused a ripple in American society. But in terms of the history of the Iraq War, Bosfeld's death is significant because it, along with the rocket attack a few hours later on the hotel inside the Green Zone where Wolfowitz was staying, marked the beginning of the insurgency's Ramadan offensive. This was the first time since the invasion that the foe turned fully on U.S. forces, bringing the highest rate of American fatalities since the spring. At 6:10 a.m. on the morning of Sunday, October 26, at least six rockets struck the Al-Rashid Hotel, the CPA lodging inside the Green Zone. Wolfowitz, who was staying there during a quick visit, was uninjured, but an army officer on the floor below him was killed. The rocket barrage likely was intended to get Wolfowitz, as was the downing of a Black Hawk helicopter near Tikrit the day before, just after his visit there. The attacks were militarily insignificant, but politically meaningful. The insurgents had been able to reach into the heavily protected Green Zone and threaten the life of a senior U.S. official who had been instrumental in the drive to war. Within a few days, another sad milestone had been passed. More U.S. troops had died in combat since May 1st, when President Bush had declared major combat operations finished, than during the spring invasion. In an odd echo of his "bring 'em on" comment in July, Bush, who was meeting with Bremer in the Oval Office, interpreted the insurgency's escalation as a sign of progress. "The more successful we are on the ground, the more these killers will react," Bush said, Bremer at his side. "The more progress we make on the ground, the more free the Iraqis become. The more electricity is available, the more jobs are available, the more kids that are going to school, the more desperate these killers become, because they can't stand the thought of a free society." This prompted an officer to send off a reporter heading to Iraq with the warning, "Be careful, or you might become another sign of progress." Insurgent attacks grew both more numerous and more sophisticated during Ramadan 2003. In the summer, there had been about 10 to 15 attacks on U.S. soldiers a day. By mid-October, that had doubled to 20 to 35 a day. By mid-November, as the Ramadan offensive was in full swing, they were peaking at 45 a day. Also, for the first time, the insurgents began having success attacking aircraft. In late October, in an apparent attempt to target Wolfowitz while he was visiting, a UH-60 Blackhawk was brought down by insurgent fire. No one was killed. In early November, a CH-47 Chinook was downed west of Baghdad, killing 16 soldiers. A few days later, another Blackhawk was hit near Tikrit, killing six. Later in the month, two Blackhawks collided over Mosul as one tried to evade ground fire, killing 17 soldiers from the 101st Airborne Division. Also, attempts to down less vulnerable fixed-wing aircraft were stepped up, with missile and rocket launches at flights at the Baghdad airport. None was successful, but one came extraordinarily close, with the surface-to-air missiles destroying an engine on the left wing of a big DHL Airbus 300 cargo jet as it took off on November 21. Attacks in Baghdad also continued, with a series of rockets launched from donkey-pulled carts at the oil ministry and at the Sheraton and Palestine hotels, which were full of American contractors and reporters. Behind the scenes, there was concern among commanders. In just 2 weeks, some 60 American soldiers had died. As the Ramadan offensive intensified, worry grew that the enemy would attempt to stage a spectacular series of attacks on Eid, the holiday that ends the holy month. "We believe there would be an Eid al-Fitr culmination, so it was a ramp-up to stop that," Swanick said later. "In Anbar province, we got their attention." There was a new edge of toughness to the public comments of American officials at this time. On November 11, Rumsfeld, defining the situation quite differently than he had in June, told a television interviewer, "We're in a low-intensity war that needs to be won, and we intend to win it." The same day, Sanchez told reporters in Baghdad, "We're going to get pretty tough, and that's what's necessary to defeat this enemy, and we're definitely not shy about doing that when it's required, and we will do that in a precise intel-driven mode." The next day, both sides made major moves. A car bomb hit the Italian military headquarters in southern Iraq, killing 18 Italians and 8 Iraqis. It was the deadliest attack on a coalition partner of the U.S.-led occupation. It was also the greatest loss of life suffered by the Italian military since World War II. On the U.S. side, the 1st Armored Division launched an operation in Baghdad called Iron Hammer that involved 26 artillery and mortar attacks and 27 missions by strike aircraft. AC-130 gunships, which carry machine guns and a 105mm cannon, began flying nightly missions over Baghdad. To curb the IED attacks, soldiers were ordered to shoot to kill anyone seen digging holes alongside roads at night. In Baqaba, Lieutenant Colonel Mark Young, commander of a battalion in the 4th Infantry Division, said that more tonnage of munitions was used by his unit than ever before in Iraq. This is to demonstrate one more time that we have significant firepower and can use it at our discretion, he said. To any American familiar with one of the most basic concepts of counterinsurgency campaigns, that they succeed when a minimum of firepower is employed, that was a troubling statement. Lieutenant Colonel Holshek, the civil affairs officer in Baqaba, was growing increasingly frustrated with attitudes like that, especially when he saw them displayed by his commander, the aggressive Colonel Hogg. One day during a briefing in November, Holshek took the unusual step of challenging Hogg with a question. "Sir, what is the battle space?" he asked. For a tough combat commander like Hogg, the answer was self-evident. In conventional war, it usually is wherever you are fighting the enemy. His answer was basically, "the bad guys," Holshek recalled. "Sir,